Today on What's My Age Again, we have a very special guest. I'm Katherine Ryan, and today I'm talking to the writer and actor, Dame Sheila Hancock.
I've not been going to the gym, and my legs are getting a bit feeble, so I need to do some of those pushy exercises. It's a battle keeping alive, isn't it, really? There will come a time when I will actually think, had enough of this.
Yeah.
I'm off. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I know. It's far from that at the moment.
Sheila Hancock, your biological age is... Sheila Hancock is 92 years old, but refuses to let her age define her. She has had an award-winning career on the stage and screen, and had two long marriages to the actors Alec Ross and John Thaw, who she was with for 28 years. Too long for me. She has three daughters and a brood of grandchildren who she says keep her young. She's still working and writes about important issues that matter to her. She, like all our guests, has taken a biological age test, which we will reveal later with Dr. Nicola Conlin. Welcome to What's My Age Again, Ms. Sheila Hancock. How do you like to be referred to? Because I feel strange calling you Sheila.
Yeah, no, call me Sheila. That's what I am.
I feel that you deserve something a lot more formal.
Well, the dame thing is interesting because I've always been very secretive about it. But I met a group of dames recently and they said, no, use it, because they use sir all the time. But not now in this situation, just when I'm booking tables in a restaurant.
Yeah, I would like to use it, though.
Go on, you
dame.
Can.
Yeah, it feels disruptive. It's difficult maybe to be an LGBTQAI plus ally, a left-wing woman of the stage, and a dame.
Yeah, they're quite a progressive group of women. You're going to hear a lot from them.
Yeah.
There's a gang of them getting together to be really activators. And I'm part of, well, I'm not part of it. I just drag along in the, but it's quite powerful, a group of women from all areas of life, law, teaching, at theatre, obviously, business, all getting together and saying, right, let's change things. And that's what they're beginning to do, which I'm quite proud of.
Good. I love that you just meet groups of dames where you go. I was with a gaggle of dames. What is the collective? Probably like crows, maybe a murder of dames.
A murder of dames would be good. Yeah. Yeah.
I like that very much. Yes. Well, I cannot believe that you're here. You look effervescent, glowing. You've never seen a day in the sun, probably all the dark theaters.
Oh, no, no. I do sit in the sun all the time.
How is your skin so young?
Well, at the moment, I've got some steroids, so I'm a bit puffy.
Oh,
so yeah. That is quite a good way of getting rid of wrinkles. but I don't know. I think you're lucky with skin, aren't you? I mean, my skin is relatively all right. I used to have acne when I was young. That was terrible. Terrible. Yeah. It was such an awful affliction. And that haunted me. But I eventually came through that. And I suppose my skin is okay, really, for my age. I do come across people the same age as me who are a lot wrinklier than I am. But I don't look in the mirror very much. I don't know what I look like.
Well, you should. I recommend it. Dame Sheila Hancock.
Well, on a few occasions I do look in, I'm not madly keen on it. So.
Oh, no. Well, I think that would be largely a hangover from your generation, because women were for decoration, I think, for a very long time, and to be seen and not heard. And it's different now, but it's probably difficult to escape that era.
Well, is it that different?
No.
Young girls are terribly keen on having the thick lips and the right eyebrows and things like that. I would have thought they're more obsessive than when I was young.
All right, Dame.
That's the first thing we disagree on.
Can we ask how old you are?
92, last February.
That's amazing. And were you at all nervous about coming here to find your biological age?
Well, I was, because the day you did it, I had inflammation because I've got this rheumatoid arthritis. And if you get a flare-up, your bloods show a lot of inflammation. So if your blood test is involved with inflammation, I will be 200. Definitely 200. But I am what I am. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you tell me I'm the age of two, it won't make any difference to the fact that my feet are aching and I'm old.
Do you think that that acceptance came to you with older age, or were you always that steadfast?
No, I wasn't always like that. I, strangely enough, reaching 90 was extraordinary, because right up until then, I honestly had never thought I was old. I really hadn't. I did a film where I climbed a mountain when I was 85, and I didn't think anything of it. I went to the gym and did a bit of extra work, but I've never thought of it. And then when I was 90, everybody started saying, "Do you still drive? Are you? Let me help you up." They suddenly start treating you as old. And you find you're acting old if you're not careful. And also it's quite useful, because it means that you can, for instance, if you're bored, or if I have had enough of this interview, I can actually say, "Well, I'm very bored with this, I'm leaving." And everybody would say, "Yeah, oh, poor old thing, she's got a bit senile." Right. It's a wonderful excuse for bad behavior.
That's right. 32, a bitch walks out of an interview. 92, the dame was tired.
Yes.
You're allowed to do what you like.
Or a bit odd.
And when would you say the rheumatoid arthritis started then?
Well, it
because
started,
you always felt
exactly.
good.
My daughter, my eldest daughter, was diagnosed with grade 3 cancer. And 2 weeks later, this is 7 years ago, I couldn't walk. And suddenly my whole body was in agony. And I thought, what's happened to me? I don't understand what this is at all. Anyway, cut a long story short, lots of tests and x-rays later, it was rheumatoid arthritis, which is now completely under control with the help of drugs and steroids and things like that. But that was when it started. So it's 7 years of learning to deal with a chronic illness.
Yeah.
But honest to God, I live a perfectly normal life thanks to modern science. I mean, in the old days with rheumatoid arthritis, I would now be utterly deformed. And none of that has happened to me. I've got one finger that's slightly bent. But other than that, I'm fine.
And that's the one you stick up at people when you're bored in an interview.
Yes.
And it's got character of its own.
Yes.
Isn't that strange with autoimmune disease, as rheumatoid arthritis is, and inflammation? It seems to affect women more than men, and it comes on in times of extreme stress.
Well, I don't think you can nail it down, actually. For me, definitely stress causes it. But for some people, I don't think it is that. It can be something they've eaten.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the awful thing about these autoimmune illnesses. It's very difficult to pin down exactly. I think AI is going to help with that.
Oh.
I think AI is now going to be very good at diagnosing things. They can already take a spot of blood and detect whether you've got cancer anywhere in the body. And so I think maybe, and with rheumatoid, you have to go through a lot of drugs before you find the one that suits you.
Yeah.
And you have to take them for 3 months to see if they work. I think that will be a thing of the past. I think AI will put you straight onto the drug that you need, says she with ridiculous confidence in the future.
Wow, I hope that you're right. There's a lot of mixed opinion about AI, and I like to hear just a hopeful projection of...
I think medically it's going to be amazing.
Right.
I really do.
And so you feel, Sheila, that with the inflammation that you had at the time that we took the test, and it was a lot to ask.
Yes.
Please come on the podcast. Please give us your blood. Please fill out the forms.
Yes, I couldn't believe it.
I'm sorry.
And sticking me with a needle. I thought, really, very odd. What is this, a podcast? I didn't sort of take in that I had to do the blood test.
Sorry about that.
But I'm not... If you tell me I'm 200, I will know it's because I had inflammation at the time. That will be my excuse.
And what about if it comes back very young?
Well, I believe it utterly if it comes back good.
Yeah.
I believe it's utterly true.
Well, then we'll have to subtract age because of the inflammation. So
yes.
If you're inflamed with rheumatoid arthritis and it comes back young, the test, the glycan age test, really does focus a lot on inflammation.
I'd be about 16.
There you go. It could be good news all around. I have to tell you, my daughter requested, she's 16, that we watch Annie last night. But the new Annie, the film with Jamie Foxx and Cameron Diaz in your original London role as Ms. Hannigan.
Right.
They've changed all the music. I think Cameron Diaz is far too young and glamorous to be Miss Hannigan. And I love the original so much.
Yes.
And it's such a legacy role. I would have loved to see you as Miss Hannigan.
Oh, that's very sweet.
What a treat.
I loved that show, actually. It was, you know, Trevor Nunn, who was then, heading the RSC, and he came to see the show, and I thought, oh God, he's going to loathe all this sentimental rubbish. And he came around and said, I couldn't like anyone that didn't love this show. Yeah. And it's one of those shows that, you know, the sun will come out tomorrow and everything's wonderful and people are kind and sweet. I think it's a lovely feel-good show, and I'd like it to be done very realistically, actually. Yeah. I mean, at the moment, it's always done as a musical, but mm-hmm. you could do it about how poverty and cruelty can be overcome by somebody loving people, you know. I'm the person that introduced the booze. I had the idea that she should be drunk half the time, so I had this little bottle and I kept taking swigs of it every time one of the awful children came along. That's but funny. I still have contact with some of the children. One of them was, no, this is where I have to show my age. She married that very old actor who's part of a family of actors.
Oh, I mean, where do we begin?
Welsh. All of them. She's Welsh.
And oh, Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Yes, she was one of my orphans.
Oh, wow.
I used to call her my wicked one.
Do you prefer performing in musicals or in theatre without music? Well, I don't know what that's called, spoken word. What's it called when there's no music? Just a play?
Play, yeah. No, I prefer musicals because I like hearing the band, and I like it's always the people in musicals, dancers and all that are lovely to work with. They're such fun. They do take it seriously, but they have a laugh, do you know what I mean? And also hearing the overture is a help. If you're feeling, oh, God, I mean, you must feel that, surely. Don't you? Do you not sometimes feel, I just can't go on and be funny?
Maybe a little, you're right, yeah.
So if you had a band,
yeah,
it would lift you a bit, I think.
Oh, musical theater is joyful, and it's a huge part of my family. We are not competent in performing musical theater, but it doesn't stop us, Sheila. And my mother and my sister are both performing in Singing in the Rain in Canada now, and in like an Amdram production.
Really?
And we always did that as kids. I just love it so much.
I love musicals.
I love you in musicals, and I feel like that would probably keep you very young, because the sheer schedule of someone perform, would it have been two shows a day, three shows a day?
Well, I did eight shows a week. You did two matinees. But also, you know, you have to keep fit for musicals. So you have to go to the gym, or you have to work out if you're dancing. And certainly you have to keep your voice in better condition than mine is at the moment. And well, actually, you have to be fit if you're going to do theatre at all.
Yeah.
Eight shows a week. But people have time off. I'm going to sound like an old fart now. But people have time off more than they used to in my day.
I'll bet.
You were never off. I never am off, because you feel the audience deserve, you know, that you at least turn up. But nowadays, people can get shows off for going to a wedding.
I know.
Or feeling a bit poorly, or... That was unheard of in my day.
But do you ever feel like that mindset is maybe a little bit abusive? Like, you grew up working hard and never taking a day off, and that was normalized. Because I wonder the same. I see the young ones really kicking back, prioritizing mental health, and I think you shouldn't do that. But maybe they're right and we're wrong.
I think they are right.
Do you think?
Yes. If I look back on my life, I wish I'd had more fun. I wish I hadn't worked so hard.
Mm.
And I wish I'd got a sense of values. I mean, I meet people. People sometimes stop me in the street, bless them, and say, oh, I loved you in... Somebody said the other day, I loved you in Two Angels.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no memory
of it
whatsoever. And in fact, nearly everything I did, I do not remember. I mean, I've got so many words in my mind, having started when I was virtually 16, so that's, what, 80-odd years of words,
mm-hmm.
that I think my mind sorts itself out and throws it away. Do you know what I mean? But I know that for that show, I would have got my knickers in a twist. I would have perfected an accent. I would have researched the background. I would have done a total waste of time. Gone into the ether.
But it might have been, even though it's in the cloud now, you filed it away, it might have been incredible mental exercise. And then your brain just put it where it needed to go, because not a lot of people are this healthy, this beautiful, this glowing, this sharp at 92. You have to admit that.
Oh, Giles Brandreth, to name but few.
That's the only other one.
He always says, I did a series with him on a boat. He used to make me remember things because he says, your memory has it there. Mm. What you've got lazy about is retrieving it. And he said, the more you don't retrieve things, the more lazy your brain is going to get. So he'd say, no, come on, you've got to get it. You've got to get it. Think hard.
Right.
And he wouldn't let me go on until I'd done it. And sometimes it didn't, but then 5 minutes later it would come. And he was right, that deep in the recess are all those dreadful plays I did. Some of them, please, let everybody forget them. Centurions.
Oh.
Thank God it's disappeared without trace. But for some reason, I played the headmistress. Now, Alistair Sim, you're too young to remember, but he was brilliant as the headmistress in that series. It was the funniest, subtlest, original piece of work. Mm. I come along, and obviously he wasn't available, and they asked me to do it. It was a dreadful script, which even I realised, but I decided for some reason to play it Dutch.
Oh.
And I went to the Dutch embassy with this tits and bum script and said, could you tell me the accent of that with my recorder to record the things? It's there somewhere lurking to bite me.
I like it. I think you sassed it up. I can see you playing Dutch. And you had to change it. So you said a gentleman that I wouldn't know was playing the headmistress.
Do you not know Alistair Sim?
I do know of the name, yeah.
It's sad. Look him up, darling.
I will.
Comic. A eccentric comic like there's never been. George Cole was his adopted son.
Uh-huh.
And he just was a genius, an absolute genius, particularly in that series, which now is totally unacceptable. Yeah. I mean, all these girls showing their knickers and things, which we thought funny.
We accept. It's from a different time. But I have noticed in theatre, and especially with older women, it does sometimes bother me that the comedic female role is given to a man.
Yes.
Because for some reason it's funnier to have a man in that role. And there are so few roles for older female actors.
Older, very few. I think they feel it's wrong to laugh at old women. I get offered hardly anything. I long to do some comedy roles, but I think they think you should be a bit more dignified when you get old. I mean, when I was young, women weren't funny at all. You were just the butt of jokes and lots of boobs and things like that. And I've done all that. But then came along people like Victoria Wood and, well, all the girls that started writing their own material. Mm-hmm. And that was a secret. Beryl Reid, yes, but very few women writing.
Mm-hmm.
So the parts were thin on the ground. But directly the girls started writing their own stuff. They also allowed women to be grotesque.
Yeah,
you know, which up until then you could be a bit sexy, but you couldn't be utterly grotesque.
No, it was this aloofness of, it was a childlike sexy by accident.
Yes.
Even Marilyn Monroe, who knew she was being sexy, had to almost behave as though she didn't realize, and it was someone else's gaze that was deciding she was sexy.
I'm fascinated by Marilyn Monroe. It's funny you should mention her because I just found her magic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was something deep inside her. She was obviously much more intelligent than they gave her credit for, but wasn't she beautiful?
She was amazing. So compelling and unique, like you say.
Yeah, utterly unique.
And there's such a tragedy in that with her drug abuse and her untimely death and all these other things. But I think that's sometimes the magic of Hollywood. You just get it for a minute and then it's taken away.
Yeah. She obviously now could be doing her own things and it would be wonderful. But she broke a lot of boundaries, but she was just before women started making themselves felt in comedy.
Yeah. Do you think that raising three girls might have an impact on kind of where your mental energy goes, your memory, even your biological health?
Yes, is the answer to that. There's no doubt once you have children and you know this, your life is completely changed. I mean, my career was, I had to keep working because I had to make the money, but I had opportunities to go to America. I had a big success with one play and I could have gone to America with it, which would have changed the direction of my career completely. But I couldn't because I wasn't going to take my oldest daughter away from school. But very willingly made.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't say that with any regret. But yes, it changes your choices.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I find it interesting. There's one of your things that I've seen where you're getting ready to go to work and doing what you do and everything, and you're still having to do the domestic and all that. And that's the fact of life, isn't it? That it's almost impossible to combine the two.
And this is why our memories go, because we're also remembering everyone's swimming lessons, yes, and the lunches. And I think a lot of your, not just your brain power, but your physiology. I've heard from our scientist, Nicola Conlon, who will come out soon, that even having children, they're all, she doesn't use the word parasite, I do, but they will take minerals from your bones, really? And then they're born, and professionally you're split, and we're grateful and we chose to have them, but it does have an impact. And I think that after you have a baby, most women are able to bounce back biologically, but I think it's never the same. I think it's so much more mental and physical energy, especially as a working professional, than most people realize.
Yes. I mean, I think it's coming out more and more how difficult motherhood is, and particularly in modern society. I mean, it was pretty poor when I brought up my kids, but now I would be terrified if I were you. I mean, there's so many threats to youngsters and so many wrong messages, so many lies that you've got to try and make them realize are lies. Mm-hmm. I do it with my grandchildren and say, no, that's not true. Somebody's just said that. I mean, people like Trump and Boris Johnson, they say things and that's a fact.
Yeah.
Well, of course, it's not a bloody fact. It's a lie.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to distinguish between those things, I think it's really difficult for youngsters and for mothers whose duty it is to do that.
How many grandchildren do you have?
Eight. They're all grown now, you know, but they're all at an interesting stage, actually, because they're all at uni or left uni or whatever, I'm about to go to uni and doing exams. I had supper with one the other night and he's swatting away for exams. And I'm this terrible person because I'm always saying, it doesn't matter, damn, darling. It doesn't matter. As long as you scrape through your degree, who's going to ask whether it's a first or a second or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't go to university, but I want them all to do university and love education. I think it's very important. But I think some of our values with our children, we've got to be careful that we're not pushing them wrongly, I think.
And do you think that having so many of them, and it sounds like you're around them a lot, do you feel that that keeps you young?
I love hearing their version. I really do. I do. I would hate to be out of touch with young people, which is very easy to get, you know, because when you get old, there's a lot of chat about knee replacements and hip replacements and all that sort of thing. In fact, I was at a party, at a book club. I've got an all-female book club.
Mm-hmm.
And they're wonderful, wonderful. And they've all been to university and frightfully posh apart from me. And I love doing it. But we were at dinner. We had dinner. We were chatting away and we were talking about electric cars.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was saying, well, I've got a hybrid. I've got this. And I suddenly stopped and I said, girls, do you remember when we used to talk about sex? And it's true.
Yeah.
You know, we got to that age where we talk about the menopause or something. And it used to be much more lascivious and enjoyable in the old days. But we then started talking about sex. So we were all right.
Good. And I like that those women are having sex.
Well, I don't know that they're even having it, but just remembering it is nice.
Remembering it. It's probably nicer than having it in many instances. And I think the younger generation, it's important for them to stay connected to the older generation, too, because I think we're dehumanized a lot. They don't want to know about their mother having sex. They don't want to think that an older woman is still a very sexual, autonomous being. I think those are the conversations you need to have with your grandson.
There are schools, aren't there, that are doing exercise. I don't know what's happening now because there's so many problems in schools, but where they bring old people together with young people. And it is very productive on both sides.
Yeah.
It really is, to have that understanding. And I'm all for it. I'm all for it. And I mean, I don't spend enough time with my family. I should do more with my kids. But I'm fascinated. I think I probably get more out of it than they do because what do you think about and whatever is the current thing? You know, they've been teaching me all this business about hating women and all that sort of stuff because that's new to my generation, that it wasn't so explicit. There weren't what they called incels or whatever.
Yeah, the incels.
There was no sort of acknowledgement that that was a fact. This is what I do. I hate women.
Yeah.
They don't love me. They won't have sex with me. Therefore, they're vile and I'll try and do damage to them.
Right.
That's kind of new, isn't
yes.
it?
Well, I think that no one was involuntarily celibate before. They could just take what they wanted without reprieve. And now women have a choice and women are choosing to avoid a certain type of man. And that's making the entitled men feel really violent. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a thing.
I do feel sorry for the men. I do. I really do. I think it's a puzzling time for them.
Mm-hmm.
We had a conversation when all this was very hot, you know, the Me Too generation. And one of my son-in-laws, who I adore, I love my son-in-laws, and said something about, oh, God, you can't even flirt with anybody now. It's ridiculous. It's nonsense, you know, the usual thing. And his daughter said to him, Dad, I never go past a building site without people shouting, show us your tits.
Mm.
Or I never go on the tube without somebody gropes me. And he was horrified to discover that this was what her life was now.
Yeah.
As was I have to say. Mm-hmm. I mean, well, I suppose it's always been like that, but we kind of took it on board more. Now it's unacceptable.
Yeah, totally. We took it on board. I know what you mean. Yeah, it's different because we told the girls they were good.
Yeah.
And then, you're right, really ignored the boys for 10 years and at least. And then they didn't have an idea of what positive masculinity was.
No.
And so now they're confused and they've found these resources for really toxic masculinity.
Yes.
It's not great.
I suppose there are a lot of people who will hopefully be listening to this will say, what are they talking about? I don't know that, but that's going on. Because I always think there's only certain sections of the community that are getting upset about things. And you say it to somebody else and they say, well, what is it? It's all right. Seems all right to me.
And that's what I miss, actually, is having conversations that can be really productive and sometimes divisive and new to people. I think that's what's happening with the younger generation. They're afraid to have any new conversations in case someone disagrees.
Yeah.
And that has proven to be really bad. But you are working with children. You're doing a lot of writing still for The Guardian and Prospect. Do you feel, I'm going to sound like Alexander Hamilton now. Have you seen Hamilton?
No, I haven't.
Right.
I can't believe it. No, isn't that awful?
This evening, Sheila, you must go.
I know. I know. It's awful. I don't know why I have. It's one of those things that everybody's gone on about it so much. I sort of think, I feel as though I've almost seen it. But it's crazy.
I feel it's not as strong now maybe as it was when it first came out because you have to keep refreshing the cast. You'll see and you'll tell me. But they say Alexander Hamilton was constantly writing. And in one of the songs, they say, why do you write like you're running out of time? Do you feel that you write with more of a sense of urgency or do you do it for pleasure?
Absolutely, I do. Absolutely, I do. I'm desperate at the moment. My latest thing is there's going to be a big celebration of the 80th anniversary of VE Day.
Yeah.
And we're going to have a thing about how we won the war and patriotic and all that. And it's a last opportunity to pay tribute to the men who died and all that. And I want to say, but it wasn't a good time.
Mm.
There were a few people jumping around in Trafalgar Square. But in fact, we'd just seen Belsen, all the pictures coming out of Belsen. We were about to kill thousands of people with atom bombs.
Yeah.
There were men coming home that my girlfriends didn't even know who said they were their fathers and suddenly they had to obey them. It was a turmoil of a time. And the best thing we can do to pay tribute to the men who died and the women who died is to make sure it doesn't happen again. But we're not doing a lot about that.
No.
We're really not. I've been watching a program called 1933, which is the year I was born, and it's the rise of Hitler. And it is terrifying to see the equivalents, like I believe Trump is now confiscating books, and there are worse things that make Germany great again, you know, and you think, where have I heard that? And it's frightened the living daylights out of me. So I'm desperate in my pathetic little way to write about what I what I do feel and what I feel should be happening. When awful periods like this happen, like the war, there is an opportunity for wonderful change out of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we got the welfare state and we got all sorts of wonderful things with the Attlee government and all that. And this could happen when we get through this crisis. Maybe the country, the world could realise that there are things have got to change, but in a way that doesn't destroy people and doesn't cause a Third World War.
Do you think there are a lot of women your age who think like you? Because it is a little bit, I mean, it shouldn't be surprising to me to learn, well, I know the way that you think. I've read your writing and I think you're very progressive and amazing in so many ways. But I think that a lot of people would assume that the older generation aren't as progressive as you are. And it would make sense, born in 1933, that you would see political similarities. Mm-hmm. But do your friends feel the same way, that we're headed toward a repeat?
Some of them do, yeah. Some of them do, certainly. All of my contemporaries are alarmed, really alarmed,
yeah,
about what's happening in the world. And most of them do it by not watching the news or,
okay,
you know, shutting off from it. I've never been like that. I've always tried to, you know, do my bit to change things because that's what my dad told me I got to do at the end of the war. Yeah, I am alarmed and I'm desperate to have a couple more years at least where I can say what I feel.
That is a really important message. I have some less important questions to ask you about, like diet and exercise, but it feels like there's no natural segue.
Oh, cool.
First, I'm going to ask you, you've also written a lot about your marriage to your much-loved John Thaw. Are you used to having him not around now that he's been gone over 20 years, or do you ever get used to that?
I'm used to it. I found ways of dealing with it, but I'd much rather have him here.
Yeah.
And I do imagine him here quite a bit. I mean, when I watch telly, I'm always imagining how he'll be sending it up or what he'll say about Boris Johnson or whatever. I'm probably quite wrong because he was always very unpredictable, but I miss his company badly.
Yeah.
I really do. And my first husband, I loved him dearly as well. And he was wartime. He was aircrew during the war.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to see what he feels. I mean, it would be nice, wouldn't it, if we died and met people. Mind you, some people you don't want to meet, do you? But
no. Well, I'm sure that you could ghost them.
Yes.
You could you? Just, sure. Why not? If not dead, then when can you ghost someone?
Okay.
Which husband would you visit first?
I'd like to get them together, actually, because the first one died before the second one came along, so they have no reason to be angry with one another. But they were both, they had a lot in common. They were both drinkers and, you know, they were very similar volatile men, which is what I've always fallen for. Hmm. But I miss them. And I do sometimes feel a bit lonely.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? When one's worried about the world. But I'm blessed by having lovely friends. And my gay friends particularly are fabulous.
It is the dream, really,
to
have a dead husband and gay friends.
Yes.
I hate to say it.
It is the best way out.
Because you remember them fondly. If they were around now, they might be a little curmudgeonly.
Yes, yes.
The drinking, you know, the sheen of that really wears off.
Yes, it does. You're right.
And what about your drinking, Sheila?
My drinking?
Yeah, let's talk about your health. I know you're busy and you're sharp and you're beautiful and you're smart. Do you drink?
Well, I do drink, but I don't think I drink to excess.
No.
I mean, I have had periods when I've drunk every day. And then I've suddenly realised that I'm drinking every day. You know, I had 6 o'clock. Ooh, is it time to have a drink? Lovely.
That's just being
like
British.
I enjoy a drink. I mean, I need it to relax and to get a sense of proportion. So, yes, I do drink.
I think a drink at 6 o'clock is not only fine, but medically recommended in a lot of cases.
Red wine particularly.
Yeah. Well. And then diet and exercise.
Well, funnily enough, I'm starting at the gym today again.
Oh,
well. Yeah, I've not been going to the gym and my legs are getting a bit feeble. So I need to do some of those pushy exercises. So I spoke to my gym and said, can I trial a month seeing if at 92 you can still benefit from going to the gym? So I'm going to start.
You should convince them. At 92, it should be month to month. Yes. Like, don't put me into, you know, a 10-year contract.
No.
I'm 92. Just play it up, I think.
Exactly.
Start to exploit 92.
Well,
rather than people trying to lift things for you and tell you that you should be weak.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yes, I will try that. My idea is that they should be able to advertise that I've benefited hugely, and they get lots of 92-year-olds along coming, joining for a short period.
See, you are thinking like the younger generation with the hashtag spawn. You shouldn't do anything for free. You should be really? Sponsored. Yeah. Everything that you do now. Do you have social media accounts?
No. Well, I don't. No.
You should get one of the grandchildren to make a social media account. You will see in real time how adored you are. You can get your message out. Your political message, all your writing goes through the social media. People will love you, Sheila.
And she tells me the nice things and not the nasty.
There will not be nasty things. And then you get the gym photos up there. 92, looking 39. And then the money rolls in.
That's not one of my main interests, believe it or not.
But it's fun, though, knowing you can do it.
Yes, I suppose so. But it's as much as I can do to deal with my emails.
Yeah.
I have hysterics when I finish this and I look, I'll have at least, they keep giving me apps. I've got thousands of apps that I don't want. No. I didn't ask for. So I really couldn't cope with anything else.
You couldn't imagine being born in 1933, this world of electric cars and AI and apps. It's too much, too fast.
Too much. I'm quite good. I'm quite techy.
Yeah.
But I do get lost sometimes. But my eldest daughter is very good, and she usually comes in and sorts me out.
It's the Quaker in you. I think Quaker women do a lot.
Quaker women are pretty good, yeah. Well, they've always been at the forefront of change.
Yeah.
You know, they were very behind the suffragettes.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, and the originator of Quakerism was a woman called Margaret Thell. It's the man who's usually talked about, but he had this woman called Margaret Thell. And she used to go down to London, which would take about a week, and talk to Charles II. She once accosted him on a tennis court about peace or something like that. And they've always been at the forefront. They've never been pushed aside in the Quaker religion as they are in the main church.
Mm-hmm.
So they've always been quite proactive.
I like that. I'm going to get into it, I think. I would like it.
A lot of people that are Quakers are atheists, even.
Yep.
You know, and a lot of different religions come. Meeting for worship is silent and wonderful. And I need it badly. Mm-hmm. I need it because I'm so noisy and talkative and I don't think enough. I rush into things, whereas Quakers don't. They're measured and peaceful. And I've been really upset that all these Trumpy things are happening.
Mm-hmm.
And there hasn't seemed to be a lot of protest. I mean, last time Trump came in, there were marches and all sorts of demos. It's begun to start now, but there wasn't anything. So when I heard that half a dozen girls are organising peach demos in the meeting house at the Quakers, I felt so happy mm-hmm. that somebody was doing something. Even if they did get arrested and bailed, they've done nothing wrong. I mean,
no.
And I think to be arrested by a Met officer with handcuffs, a young girl, is not great.
No,
not great.
It was as publicized. It's not a good look.
Yeah, yeah. The Sunday Times did it as a headline.
Wow.
Immediately after, it's still bubbling along. It's shocking. It's deeply shocking because it's. They said that they'd heard that they were planning to bring London to a standstill. Now, they probably did say that. Mm-hmm. A, they couldn't possibly do that, bless them, in the best will in the world. They couldn't bring the whole of London to a standstill. But also, that's allowed, but not now. You mm-hmm. see, there's a little clause come into demos that you can't do anything that will disrupt or upset people. Do you know what I mean?
Okay.
So the very reason that you're doing it is being taken away. You've got to behave nicely and just say, please, will you not send weapons to Israel and Palestine and everywhere?
Well, I think that some of this mindfulness, of the Quakers will be reflected in your biological age, because Dr. Nicola Conlon always says that's good.
Oh, really?
The quiet, it's good for your cells. Before we bring out Dr. Conlon, can I ask you, Sheila, how old do you feel?
Well, at the moment, I feel young,
yeah,
talking to you. I feel no age. Sometimes when I'm a bit cranky and when my legs are not working as I would like to, then I feel about 80, but I never feel what's expected of me. I feel I let people down with 90.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I'm a bit of a failure at 90.
Yeah.
Not good at doing that. I'm getting better because I'm getting worse.
But okay.
Do you know what I mean? I caught myself in the mirror. I never look in the mirror if I can help it. But I was bent over.
Mm.
I was literally bent over. It was the end of the day. I was tired. My back was aching and I looked old.
We all do.
Do we?
Yeah. I mean, I hate to think of my husband's view. Sometimes I do need that facelift. You've never thought about doing anything like that? You don't do Botox, you don't do facelift, filler, nothing. Yeah. You just look like that naturally.
Well, you know, I've got lots of lines and things. I once had things for here just because I was getting a furrow there, but I just feel so strange.
Great.
With it. I did, but I'm absolutely for people doing it. Though you look lovely, and I know you say you've had things.
I've pulled back.
But you see, I was never beautiful. I think I was at RADA with Joan Collins, who was exquisitely beautiful. And I can understand if you looked like that, A, what a blessing, and B, I'm sure have done everything I could to preserve it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's worth preserving. But because I've always been a bit odd looking, it didn't seem necessary to bother about it. Do you know what I mean? And as I've grown older, it's been a bit of a relief not to wear makeup and not to have to worry about looking lovely and all that.
Well, I will say, not that you care, but I think there was a very narrow idea of traditional beauty back then. And I have seen photos of you from all along your career. I think you're beautiful now. I think you'd be very surprised that you are considered beautiful now. But even as a young woman, you would be considered out of this world beautiful now, because we accept different ways of being beautiful. So you are very beautiful.
I don't think I'd have been ever considered beautiful, but certainly
wrong.
I wouldn't have been rejected in the way that I was in my profession, because I was very tall, which you couldn't be, because you could never be taller than a leading man, and also unconventional looking. But now, thank God, all that has gone out of the window.
Yeah.
Thank God you can look and be exactly what you want to be. And I think it's so much more interesting for the public and everything.
And what would you say to anyone who's worried about aging or scared?
Well, if it's about the way they look, then I don't think I can help them, really, because you do begin to look older and sadder. What I would say is you're fine, but when you get a bit older, I think that's when it starts to be dodgy. If you still try to look what you did when you were 20.
Yeah.
For a while, until about 50, maybe even 60, it's acceptable. But after that is when people begin to look not great.
Right.
I think. And it's better to then let go and just become a reasonable looking old person.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
And to have other interesting things about you.
Yes.
How sad, actually, for these very traditionally cookie-cutter, beautiful women of that era, that they really didn't have a reason to develop anything else. It could probably be a blessing and a curse, quite stifling.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that it's time, Sheila.
Oh, dear.
Dame Sheila Hancock, to bring out Dr. Nicola Conlon and reveal your biological age.
Okay.
I'm excited. Sheila Hancock, your biological age is 72,
Woo.
20 years younger than your chronological age. And that is in the midst of a rheumatoid arthritis flare.
Wow.
How do you feel?
Well, I'm surprised. 20 years younger, that's... Because I really was in a bad way. So maybe I should always have a rheumatoid flare.
Well, this is what I mean. This is our resident scientist, Dr. Nicola Conlan. Please help us, Nicola, interpret these results. Because as Sheila said herself, she was sick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you judge it by, the blood thing? Are you looking at inflammation or?
Yes. So this test, it's called a glycanage test. And it is actually looking at levels of inflammation. But... the key thing here is it actually looked at what the inflammation's been like in your body over around 3 months.
So it's
not very specific on the day. And it's more like, you know, is it what is on average has happened during the last 3 months?
Oh, well, normally it's normal.
So normally it's okay. Yeah. Yeah. But what we know, because what this test is measuring, obviously you've got your chronological age, which is 92, but this is your biological age. This is the age you are on the inside, and this is the age that your cells are. And that's way more important, because that's a really good predictor of health, way more than just what your birth certificate says.
Well, good. So I might live a few more years then.
Yeah. Well, the fact that you are 20 years younger, and normally at this point, Catherine will always say to me, okay, explain the results. But I would like you to explain the results, because clearly you have done something throughout your life or whatever you're doing now that is really giving you this spectacular result of being 20 years younger. So, you know, do you have any insights as to any key parts of your life, your lifestyle that you just feel have been important?
A mental attitude, probably. Mm. You know, I'm quite curious.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think my outlook has not become old when I meet contemporaries. Mm. But physically, I mean, I've always, because of my profession and your profession, I've kept fit.
Yeah.
Yes, I have. I've gone to the gym. I've done dance. I've eaten sensibly.
Yeah.
Well, not always, but I've mainly eaten sensibly, except, of course, one eats after the show and all the silly things. But so I've taken reasonable care of myself, but not massive good care.
But all of those things are really important. Exercise, diet,
you
know, lifestyle plays a much bigger role than we think when it comes to aging well. And I liked what you were talking about saying, you know, you almost become where you're expected to act a certain way. And, you know, you've got to be careful to not start acting your age because of what society thinks. And, you know, as someone who specializes in longevity, we see this sort of societal expectation where we have this expected life trajectory where I always say you're born, you learn, you earn, you retire, you expire. And, you know, you think you retire and then that's it. But you've not let that happen. And that is such an important part, because we know having a sense of purpose in life is massively linked to biological age.
It's quite a struggle to keep it going, though. It really is, because the world is against you.
Yeah.
I mean, people work-wise, I'm sure they think, well, they wouldn't engage me for a series because, obviously, I'm probably not going to last that many more years. Mind you, now I'm only 72. I might add a few more years to it. Yeah. But you do have to fight to not succumb to expectations of what people think of 90. You really do. But then I suppose that's true of any age. When you're little, you're pretending to be older, aren't you? But I know that I am better than most of my contemporaries in terms of health.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't had any replacements or anything like that. But then I think I've got quite a high, or whatever it is, pain threshold. Mm. I'm quite good with pain. So I do have a pain in my hip that I think some people might say, oh, I need a hip replacement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I don't. I just think, oh, occasionally my hip hurts.
Yeah.
But I think people... you know, are more apt to have intervention than I am.
And have you ever had any major illnesses at all?
I had cancer.
Did you?
I had breast cancer, yes. And I did go on a special diet for a year. Mm. There was a marvellous man called Dr. Latto, who was an alternative, and used to have injections of mistletoe. Mm. And I refused chemo. I had radiotherapy. And much to their fury, because this is way back in the 70s, 80s, And they wanted to throw the book at me with it. And I said, no. And I had a wonderful, very enlightened consultant called Dr. Spittle. And she said, well, look, I'll give it a year, she said. But if there's any signs of recurrence, I'm going to throw the book at you. But I went on this meat-free diet. I lived mainly on raw vegetables.
Wow.
For about a year. Yeah. And a bit of cheese, tiny bit of cheese, but very. So his theory was that the liver needed to be free to get rid of the poisons. Mm. So you don't lumber it with coffee. And I didn't drink or anything like that for a whole year. Wow. And I came out and I was fine.
Yeah.
I was fine. I've never had a recurrence.
Were you working at that time?
Yeah. Yeah. I was actually working when I got the diagnosis, and I worked that night when I'd been told, yeah.
I can't imagine 8 shows a week on raw vegetables, Sheila.
But food is actually medicine.
Do you know, I do it occasionally now. I quite like it. All you do is you chop up raw vegetables and put a nice dressing on it, nice olive oil type dressing, and a potato in its jacket and a bit of cheese. It's really tasty, actually.
Okay.
If you're feeling a bit off colour, it's a good lifter.
And you don't cook them?
No. And you have raw cabbage, raw red cabbage particularly, celery, onions, apple, beans, anything, all chopped up and then mixed with a dressing. It's very tasty. Very tasty. Mm.
And I really wanted to ask you as well about how much of a role you think, you know, being involved with the Quakers in that sort of society, you know, of a collective group of people working together and, you know, having that sense of community. And also it's clear that you have a very good group of friends around you. Do you feel like that's something that really helps you stay?
It does help me. It does. Yeah. And I think most people, I think loneliness is a modern disease and certainly one for the old.
Yes.
So my old people sometimes don't speak to anybody for days on end.
Mm.
And that must be a nightmare.
And we know this scientifically now. So there was actually a study that came out that said loneliness is actually, you know, comes with the same health risks as smoking 15 cigarettes a day.
Really?
Yeah, that's the comparison.
Because
loneliness can affect the immune system. It can cause inflammation.
I can believe that.
Yeah.
I can believe that. And I think the books I write seem to get lots of letters, you know, people, because one book I wrote, the two of us, talks about alcoholism and all sorts of things and certainly bereavement. So I get lots of letters saying thank you or can you help me or whatever. And one of the things I always say, I often get people saying, oh, I'm so lonely without my husband, I can't bear it. And I say, well, join something.
Yeah.
There are people that need you. Go to the local school, see if you can read stories to the kids, anything to get with a group, local church, whatever. People have got to make I had a mad sister who's 10 years older than me with blue hair. And she ended up living in France with a lot of other cabaret artists and people. And it was so embarrassing to go with her because she lived in France for about 20, 30 years and she never learnt the language. She's still called Nice. You know, honest to God. And you go out with her and she'd sit on a bench with a lot of French people say, hello, darling, I'm Billy. What's your name? And she'd just shout at them like English people do. But she communicated the whole time.
Yeah.
She was, although she lived on her own, she would go to a park and she'd chat to everybody, absolutely everybody. Yeah. And I advocate that. We're too frightened of making approaches and being polite, I think.
Yeah, and I love that you're sharing that message with people because the importance of that, you know, it's something we've kind of known but never been able to really prove. But there was a study that literally came out in the last couple of weeks and they'd followed, I think it was 700 people over 85 years. And the most important thing above diet, lifestyle, everything was feeling like you had a sense of community and good relationships and friends. That was the number one predictor of good health.
That's
so it's wonderful that you're sharing that because loneliness is really, really bad.
And I think the message has got to be you have to make an effort for that. You can't wait for it to come to you.
Yeah.
If you feel lonely, do something about it. Go join the local church or if you don't want to go to the church, then some sort of society, offer your help to a charity.
Mm.
There are plenty of people, or just sit on a park bench and talk to somebody. They're not going to hurt you. If there are people around, obviously you don't do it in a deserted place, But the worst they can do is say, F off, you know. Mm. I mean, it's not going to harm you. And it's like people say, oh, I can't go in a restaurant on my own.
Yeah.
That's nonsense. Take a paper with you or a book and just sit and read and then maybe chat to somebody at the next table. Make an effort. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult when you're lonely because you're insecure, but you can do it.
Especially if there are ailments, like if people start to lose their hearing,
yes,
that can be quite isolating.
That is very isolating. Yeah. That's absolutely right, Catherine. People, we don't, being deaf, I'm deaf, I've got hearing
aids. Are you?
Yeah, I've got hearing aids.
Oh, great.
That is the worst thing. I because if it's a busy room and everybody's talking, I can't hear. It's horrible. Yeah. It's absolutely horrible. You feel so, and then people talk to you like a baby. They bend down and say, hello, can you hear me? And so it becomes, I think, we don't do enough about hearing. Some people never, ever have hearing aids, do they? Mm-hmm. They become deaf.
Yeah.
No need for that.
Yeah. And why is that? Do you think that there's shame in asking, or they don't want to go to the doctor, they don't realize they've gone deaf?
Right. Mm-hmm. If ever I do a chat in the public, you know, when you're publicizing books and you do these literary tours, I always get round to talking about, like hearing aids. I call them deaf aids. And there's always somebody saying, it's not a deaf aid, it's a hearing aid. But, you know, just subjects like that so that people can open up. Because people stifle these painful things, don't they? And they can really upset them. And I believe somebody said to me, you're very outspoken, Sheila, because I'd obviously offended him. But I much prefer to be with people who say it as it is.
Yeah.
I'm sick of people saying, do you mind if I tell you that I think you'd be better if you, or can I pass, do you mind? We're so over-polite in this country.
And that almost creates an anxiety in itself.
Yes.
And like you can't just say what you want to say. And anxiety causes inflammation.
Absolutely.
And inflammation ages you. So yeah, say it how it is.
People not wanting to talk about the political situation and all that as well. Yeah. Stifling it rather than, you know, you can have a row even. It's better than just being upset and not talking about things.
Yeah.
I'm making it sound as though I've got all the answers, which I certainly haven't. But now I'm told I'm 72. I do know that I'm better than, in better condition than some other people I know in their 80s.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But I look at them and I think, come on, you're overweight, or you're not walking enough, or you're not communicating enough, and why are you so frightened? And
and when you say you feel like you're in better condition, so this is a concept that we talk about called our health span. You know, everyone's so focused on your lifespan, which is how long you'll live, but really it's the health span, it's that proportion of your life
Absolutely.
That you're living healthily, that you can enjoy. That's really the important bit. And the sad fact is that at the minute, for a woman in the UK, whilst our lifespan's expected to be 83 years, our health span is only expected to be 64 years.
You're joking.
So it means,
what happens after that?
You're expected to have, you know, poor health, so one or more chronic conditions.
God.
And I think, you know, so it just shows, I mean, you are in amazing health. You know,
I suppose I am, but I can understand why people, I mean, you can be healthy in one of those chariots, can't you? If your legs actually do give out, because, you know, let's face it, some people cannot walk very well when they're 90, but you can still feel healthy and within the limitations of having to help moving around.
Yeah.
But what I'm going through at the moment is that, which is why I'm going to the gym again, is that my muscles are not as good as they should be. And I'm going to see if I can tone them up. And if I can't, then I'm going to have to think about having some kind of vehicle. I've heard about one that you can go at 10 miles an hour, but you can actually go on the road.
That's cool.
I've always had beautiful cars. I'm mad about cars. And I, the thought of being in some sort of invalid carriage is daunting. And it's like wheelchairs. I will never have a wheelchair. I can't bear it. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I may have to.
Yeah.
I may have
to. I do believe that you absolutely will still be able to build muscle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, this is where people are almost said, oh, no, you're too old for that. But what all the science shows is that there isn't too old of an age to start doing anything.
Really?
Yeah, exercise, diet, healthy eating, changing lifestyle. There isn't a top age where it's like, let's just not bother anymore.
Right.
So I you know, commend you. Get to the gym. Absolutely. Build the muscle.
Well, it's I will do.
It's not
I'll try.
Something that's not achievable.
Some people, you know, if you sit too long in a chair, you get very achy, don't you? I do. Anyway, it's quite an effort. Like when I was stood up just now, it's quite an effort. But it's a battle keeping alive, isn't it, really? I can understand there will come a time, I've said this to my kids, there will come a time when I will actually think, had enough of this.
Yeah.
I'm off. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I know it's far from that at the moment,
yeah, no.
But sometimes when I had this blood test actually, and I was in a bad flare, and you wake up in the morning and it's really difficult getting about, and you think, oh, this is no bloody life. I don't like this very much. Mm. But then, strangely enough, if you force yourself to go out and do something, you feel fine.
And it's that old advice of, I think, in the 40s and 50s, was it? They'd say, just splash cold water on your face and go outside.
Yes.
And you're not allowed to say that anymore. That even is offensive, but it does wonders.
Yes, yes.
At any age, it's not the perfect answer.
But what about you? You how do you feel about getting older?
I don't mind. I like the idea of becoming stronger in my voice, becoming more of a disruptor. I think just being an opinionated older woman is such a virtue. I think it's wonderful.
Yeah.
And I hope that I will be in good health at that time.
Yeah.
Currently, I'm still having babies, though, and like...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Very old to be doing that. So I don't know.
Sometimes. Yes, I was 30-something with my first one and 40-something with the last one.
Good. Well, maybe that's a good indication for me at 92. What do you think about the drinking, Nicola?
You know, there is some evidence that a small amount of alcohol actually can be beneficial.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So
how much is that?
I don't know the exact amount. I mean, it depends how large you pour your glasses of wine, you know, if you use a proper measure or not. But we know that the relationship with alcohol is actually surprising. It's kind of like too much is obviously bad. The too little there seems to be a benefit of having a little bit, so somewhere in the middle.
There are still some people that say you shouldn't drink it.
Yeah, some studies show nothing, you know, absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
But there are definitely some studies that show a little bit is actually beneficial when it comes to biological age. Now, is that because maybe that's those people are more social? You know, they're actually going out. They're going to restaurants.
They're relaxing.
You know, yeah, it might be a different story. And I don't know if they're controlled for this, like if it was just people at home on their own drinking, you know, by themselves. So it could be that it's a mix of the social element that sometimes comes with, you know, going out with your friends and having a glass of wine.
I think what I think it's good for is if you've had a tough day, just at 6 o'clock, that's my big hour, is just to have a bit of wine can be really nice, can't it? Really. I'm gathering together nice experiences. I remember John had this towards the end of his life. John was really a depressive, particularly when he was drinking. And a bloke that he went to said, look, you just don't enjoy yourself. You've got all this success and you're not treating yourself. You're treating everybody else. And he made him buy a terrible magazine with all sorts of techie things and made him buy some presents for himself. And I think, and I'm exactly the same as him. We have similar backgrounds and we don't think we deserve to enjoy ourselves. We should be looking after everybody else. And I think it's quite a difficult thing to do, to say, I'm going to treat myself. I deserve a little bit of a treat.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what I'm going to work on for a bit for myself. I'm going to say, no, I can't do that job or whatever. I'm going to go and sit in the sun.
Yeah. Will this result change the way you live at all?
Well, it's actually cheered me up a bit.
Good.
I don't know how much I can trust it, but I have begun to think, and found myself thinking, have I got a couple of years? And how many years might I have? 92, 94, maybe 2 years. But now, if I really have a healthy age, then I don't see any reason why, if I work at it, that I shouldn't live a few more years than I think, as long as I don't fall over. Falling over is the big thing.
You're fine.
Having a fall, mm-hmm. as they call it.
That's it. I was going to say, if you call it falling over, you're fine.
Yeah.
You didn't say having a fall, so no. You're all right.
No.
Well, Dame Sheila Hancock, it has been such a joy and an honor for us to have you on What's My Age Again.
It's been my pleasure.
And your biological age is younger than mine.
Is it?
Yes. And you're just so amazing in so many ways and very inspirational too.
Oh, well, it's been lovely. Thank you. I've enjoyed it. Talking rubbish, but...
That's all I know how to talk is rubbish. Thanks to Sheila Hancock for joining us on What's My Age Again. Sheila writes in The Guardian and in Prospect magazine, and her books include The Two of Us, Just Me, and Old Rage, which, even before reading it, I know is going to be my favorite. Thanks so much for listening. Be sure to follow us at whatsmyageagain_pod across social media. And don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. Until next time.